This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Let's begin this morning with a word of prayer. Lord, we do thank you again that we can come into your holy presence knowing that our Savior Jesus Christ intercedes for us. We would not dare to stand before you apart from his merit and intercession. We do thank you for the grace and mercy you have shown us in him and ask that you would be with us this day. Empower us by your Spirit to glorify your name, be faithful to your word. We ask for clear minds as we study this new material. I ask that you would help us to understand it and make good application of it, that we would live lives that are more pleasing to you, and that we might be more persuasive in our dealing with others, and that we might better glorify our Savior, who is the truth. For it's in his precious name that we pray. Amen. We're going to begin today where we left off yesterday. Yesterday's lecture was a discussion of argumentation, what goes into an argument, different kinds of arguments, inductive, deductive, the relationship of truth and validity, what the nature of logic was, and I gave you a very brief theological overview of logic and why there's a good biblical warrant for doing it, even though we have to have some kind of restraint on our adulation of logic as well. Anyway, that was yesterday's lecture, and now I've had you read the first chapter in Copy's book that covers some of the same ground, and the first chapter in Morris Engel's book that covers some of the same ground on the nature of logic and argument. Now, what I'm going to do is go through the books and just review the chapter, and as we come to various exercises, then we'll stop and do some exercises and make sure that we've caught on to this thing. So, if you will, turn with me in your Copy textbook, Introduction to Logic, the 8th edition, and I'll just go over the things that I have underlined that are worthy of repeating. Copy begins by asking, what is logic? Since this is a textbook on logic, that won't surprise you. And he tells us at the very beginning, logic is the study of the methods and principles used to distinguish good from bad reasoning. Or you could put it, correct from incorrect reasoning. And I hope you can see in that a reflection of what I taught you yesterday. Logic is a second-order discipline. It looks at those who are engaged in first-order argumentation, arguing about politics or about biology or whatever it may be. The logician looks at arguments and tries to discern the principles that will help distinguish correct from incorrect reasoning. He adds right away that this is not to imply that only the student of logic can reason well or correctly, any more than only the student of baseball can hit a home run. That isn't true. Copy tells us in the next paragraph that logic is an art as well as a science. It's something that you can be trained in, but you have to have some initial ability in as well. And then as we turn the page to page 4, he tells us that if we study logic, we'll gain acquaintance with the pitfalls that have to be avoided in reasoning. We'll also gain methods for testing the correctness of any different kinds of reasoning. He says something interesting in the next paragraph. He tells us that appeals to reason are more effective than appeals to emotion. I don't think at first we'd be inclined to agree with that. We're often discouraged, aren't we, at how appeals to emotion seem to sway people. And they don't listen to good reason. What he says, though, is that the appeal to reason is more effective in the long run and can be tested and appraised by criteria. Well, maybe he's not a Christian as far as I can see. Maybe he's a post-millennial unbeliever, though, in that he thinks in the long run reason wins out. I'm not so sure that is true to human nature. He didn't come to take a class on theological anthropology, but in the long run, it seems to me, appeals to emotion have long-lasting effects. I mean, what happens in a culture, politically, socially, what have you. Anyway, this much is true. Appeals to reason can be tested. That's the sort of thing that's more open to objective evaluation and discussion and dialogue than our appeals to emotion. I told you this yesterday, and it's repeated here, that logic is not the science of the laws of thought, nor is it the science of thinking, because, in the first place, psychologists also study thought and thinking Moreover, not all thinking is reasoning, he tells us. And then if somebody would say, okay, well, then logic's the science of reasoning, he goes, well, same problem. Psychologists still include reasoning as one of the kinds of thinking that they would study. And so on the top of page 5, we get this important observation. The logician, however, is concerned primarily with the correctness of the completed process of reasoning. Psychologists are not concerned with whether the reasoning is correct or incorrect. And they're more concerned with the process, the actual, what goes on in the head of somebody, than they are with the completed product, you know. Logicians kind of look at the reasoning process at the complete, from the completed end backward, trying to decide whether it's correct or incorrect reasoning. And then he reminds us that the distinction between correct and incorrect reasoning is the central problem with which logic deals. So that's right back to where we began. Logic is the study of the methods and principles used to distinguish correct from incorrect reasoning. All seems so simple when you put it that way, and then we're going to, the more we go into this, we're going to see what a huge field can be. I trust you'll really profit from it, though. You'll learn not only in your own thinking, but as you watch the TV or talk to people. And these things will come back to you, and you say, oh, yeah, see how language is being used here, and how this is being defined, and what's wrong with that argument, so forth. It will improve your own mental apparatus, I'm sure. Okay, section 2 distinguishes between premises and conclusions. This is not all that difficult. Coppi tells us inference is a process by which one proposition is arrived at and affirmed on the basis of one or more other propositions. So inference is that process itself. And then he tells us that propositions can be asserted or denied, can be true or false. And that's not true of other kinds of linguistic functions. Exclamations aren't true or false. Commands are not true or false. But propositions are. And then he distinguishes between sentences and the propositions that sentences utter. Two sentences, say in two different languages or having two different grammatical forms, may assert the same proposition. And then on page 6, he tells us that in different contexts, exactly the same sentence can be uttered to make very different statements. He uses the example of the present president of the United States is a former congressman. At some times, that would be true, and at other times, it would not be true. So the sentence is open-ended a bit, but the proposition that is asserted and is intended by that sentence is not. Okay, in the middle of the page, he says, corresponding to every possible inference is an argument. And it is with arguments that logic is chiefly concerned. An argument is any group of propositions of which one is claimed to follow from the others, which are regarded as providing support or grounds for the truth of that one. You remember this from yesterday? An argument, then, is a group of propositions where one is said to follow from the others, or the others are supposed to provide evidence for the one. There's a structure to an argument, then. The conclusion is what is asserted. The premises are that upon which it is asserted. And he tells us on page 7 that the order in which the premises are given is not significant. On page 8, he begins by saying some arguments offer several premises in support of their conclusions. In the middle of the page, he tells us premise and conclusion are relative terms because the same proposition can in one context be a premise and in another context be a conclusion. On page 9, you can't tell the difference between a conclusion and the premise just in terms of the position you find them in the formulation of the argument. Sometimes premises are stated first and conclusion last. Sometimes conclusion first, premises last. Sometimes they're mixed up. And so he gives a list of conclusion indicators and a list of premise indicators. And it would be good for you to look at those. They are not the be-all and end-all. There are other ways in which we have to find premises and conclusions when they aren't found, for instance. And sometimes language like them is used, and it's misleading. It's not really an indication of the premise or conclusion. But in most cases, this is pretty helpful to know. You find the conclusion after words like therefore, or hence, or thus, or so, accordingly, in consequence, or consequently. Something proves that. or as a result of this, for this reason, or reasons. It follows that. We may infer that. I conclude that. Now, that's a giveaway, isn't it? I conclude that. Which shows that, which means that, which entails that, which implies, which allows, which points.
Okay.
Different ways in which you might catch on to this is what the person's trying to demonstrate. This then is their conclusion. The premise indicators include things like since such and such, or because such and such, for this reason, as it is the case that, it follows from, and then you give premises, as shown by these premises, inasmuch as these premises are as indicated by. The reason is that, or for the reason that, it may be inferred from, may be derived from, deduced from, or in view of the fact that. All of these are common ways in English that we indicate premises in an argument. On page 11, Kopi tells us something that is a sad fact for students of logic who have to do so many homework assignments. Not everything said in the course of an argument is either a premise or a conclusion. Sometimes there's stuff there that's just irrelevant. You know, the interesting thing is that's not just a headache for students who have to do homework problems and say, now, is this important or not? Is this relevant or not? There are people you're going to find when you start using this in real life, not just in this academic setting of the classroom. There are people who have all kinds of things put into their arguments and their speeches, sometimes their term papers, which are irrelevant. You know, and they don't seem to be aware of that fact. They think, well, you know, this has something to do with the subject, but it's not really relevant to proving a point or moving the subject along. And don't anybody get hurt feelings by that last remark. I actually meant that to be applied mainly. You'll see that when you follow a debater or somebody on TV is trying to make a point, often they're filling a lot of space and you're saying, yeah, okay, but that's not relevant to proving your point. So, Kopi reminds us that. Yeah. On page 12, he says, sometimes propositions are located, are found, but not because they're in a declarative sentence. Sometimes they'll be in the form of a rhetorical question. In the middle of the page, he says, sometimes we have a noun phrase that for purposes of logic would be translated into a declarative sentence. And then on page 13, the part that made all of you so happy, he said, sometimes the formulations of arguments don't contain explicit statements of their conclusions. It's kind of like, it's supposed to be so obvious, you know, that I don't even have to state it. And then this is an important observation, the last line on that page 13. He says, some logical ability is presupposed in the study of any subject, including logic itself. Now, there's two points here. The reason why logic is such a valuable tool is because you can't study anything without using logic. Every field of endeavor uses argumentation. So logic is, in a sense, presupposed by everybody. But here's the second and, I think, even more interesting point. Even the study of logic presupposes the use of logic. As Kopi lays out his approach to logic, he's trying to be logical. He's offering arguments of his own. And then he gives a nice summary paragraph that I don't think I'm going to bother to read this morning on page 14. Puts everything together here as to what logic is, propositions, and so forth. Okay, let's do some of the exercises. And let me turn to my assign. Okay, in this first set, you were to do numbers 1 through 15. Is that right? Okay. No, I'm not having you turn them in. There may be a point at which I'll ask you whether you've done all of your homework, you know, just as a way of checking, so you don't have the temptation to say, well, he might not call on me, so I won't, you know, do this work. But, you know, you're in college now. You should be responsible. You're good Christian students. You're going to do your homework. I know that. Right? Puzzle books. Number one. We're supposed to identify the premises and conclusions in the following passages. And he tells you, it's a giveaway here, there's only one argument, so it's a little bit easier. Number one, but the price of fossil and nuclear fuel is only a small fraction of their total cost. Society pays the other costs for damaged health and property, oil spills in the oceans, polluted or poisoned rivers, lakes and beaches, acid rain, killed or poisoned fish and oyster beds, and human misery. It appears to me that the second sentence is the premise and the first sentence is the conclusion. Is that what you all got? Now, this is a start exercise. Did you check it in the back? Am I right? Okay. Now this is going, I was telling Pete on the way over a little bit, something that may not sit well with you, but it's just the fact of life. And that is, I'm going to sit here, and we may disagree over some of these, and there may not be an absolutely clear or right or wrong way of looking at some. Now, some are going to be so obvious that I have to hold you accountable for that, I guess, but in many cases where there's numerous arguments in a passage, especially, different ways of schematizing them, now you're all saying, well, last night I wish I would have known this. I wouldn't have thought there's only, you know, like in algebra, only one right answer, and so I'm trying to get to it. Some of it has to do with interpretation. And so that's why, even though I'm supposed to know this material fairly well, I look at this and I have to ask you, is that what the author said too? Did I get it right? Do we agree? Maybe that's a better way to put it. It's not who has it right, who has it wrong, but we all agreed on this, and I guess on the first one we are. So number two now. It is hard to argue that Western astrology must be true because it has such a long tradition behind it, because Chinese and Indian astrology have equally long traditions. If one is right, the others are wrong. It is hard to argue that Western astrology must be true because it has such a long tradition behind it. I'm not even sure of the grammar of this one. Yeah. Then, because Chinese and Indian astrology have equally long traditions. Okay, the conclusion seems to be something of the along the nature that it's hard to argue that Western astrology must be true because it has such a long tradition behind it. And the premises would be Chinese and Indian astrology have equally long traditions. If one is right, the others are wrong. Therefore, it's hard to argue that Western astrology is right because it has a long tradition. Is that the way you got it? Okay, how do you do it, Dean? So you want to take the last sentence as the conclusion? You think the author here is trying to convince us that if one is right, the others are wrong? Okay, I can't be absolutely sure, but it seems to me that that's not the sort of thing you need to argue for. That would be kind of obvious. If one is right, the others are wrong. And so that might have been an early tip-off, but that's not the conclusion. The author, in the first sentence, seems to be pointing to a defect in the way some people try to support astrology. And he says, I can show you that's a defective way of thinking. You know that if one is right, the others are wrong, and there are others that have equally long traditions. And so I appreciate, you know, you're working at that. It doesn't seem to me, though, that last sentence is really the conclusion. Did anyone else think it was a conclusion? Okay. Well, the conclusion could be that there, in astrology, only one can be right. That is, if one is right, the others are wrong. That could be a conclusion. It's not so much that it's a premise and a conclusion together. It's a hypothetical statement, remember? And there's a difference between that and argument. Well, let's try number three. Fair tests charge that another examination, the SAT, which most colleges use as one measure of which high school students they admit, was biased against girls, again pointing out that they as a group scored lower on that test even though they earned better grades than boys. This one's easy. Pat, take it. Right. The fact that the girls scored lower on the test and then the fact that they earn better grades than the boys shows that as a conclusion the SAT is biased against girls. Okay, number four. Lying is as much a part of normal growth and development as telling the truth. The ability to lie is a human achievement, one of those abilities that tends to set them apart from all other species. Okay, Jay? Yeah, anybody have any problem with that? Human achievement ambiguous? Probably. The fact that it's a bad argument or that it has ambiguities and it doesn't change with the structure of the argument is though, and that's all you need to worry about in this exercise. Yeah, I suppose you could say the ability to lie is a human achievement, premise one. Ability to lie is an ability that tends to set humans apart from other species, premise two. And then conclusion, lying is as much part of normal growth and development as telling the truth, is your conclusion. But now, I think Pete's suggesting that the ability to lie is a human achievement might be the conclusion. And looking at that, well, that's interesting. Then you'd have as a premise, lying is as much part of normal growth as telling the truth. Another premise, lying is one of those abilities that tends to set humans apart from other species, and therefore the ability to lie is a human achievement. And actually, I think that may be superior to what was first suggested. Now, please don't be too frustrated. What happens is you have here only two sentences, three clauses, and if you don't know the context, you don't know what the guy does with this, we just kind of jump into this thing from outside. You can't be absolutely sure. But I think I would favor that second interpretation. Well, we know number five will be easy because the author gave us the answer. Now, I say that tongue-in-cheek because you know what? We can disagree with the author, too, can't we? I mean, although he may know a lot more about it than I do or you all do. That's a possibility. Okay, number five. The light we see from distant galaxies left them millions of years ago. And in the case of the most distant object that we have seen, the light left some 8,000 million years ago. Thus, when we look at the universe, we are seeing it as it was in the past. Well, listen. David, I'm not hearing you because you're talking down. What was the first clue that that was the conclusion? Yeah, the conclusion indicator thus. Very good. Number six. The advanced technology supplied in supercomputers tends to quickly permeate the entire computer industry. And so the nation that leads in supercomputer development tends to have a jump in other countries in producing more powerful and more lucrative lower-level computers. Pete. Right, and how did you know that? Very good. Conclusion indicator so gives that one away. Number seven, forbear to judge, for we are sinners all. Pat? Right. The premise would be we are sinners all. Conclusion, if we want to take it out of its imperative form, we'd say one should forbear to judge, but anyway, you've got the right order of the conclusion and premise. Number eight, males born into poverty are more likely to commit crimes with teenagers and adults than are more privileged males. So, a boom in births among poor mothers can be expected to exert upward pressure on the crime rate 15 to 20 years later. Okay? All right, and how did you know that? The word so shows you the conclusion. Number nine, he that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. Melissa? And how did you know that? Premise indicator. Very good. Number 10, Thomas More, the director of domestic studies at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, argues that poverty statistics overstate the number of poor people because researchers don't add in such non-cash benefits as food stamps or Medicaid when calculating family incomes. Pete. Okay, now let me indicate here. The part that says Thomas More argues that is not the conclusion. See, this person's not trying to prove that Thomas More said something. This is just a report on what Thomas More argued. And Thomas More's argument is conclusion, poverty statistics overstate, and its premises, researchers don't add in non-cash benefits. Is that all clear to everybody? It's not a big deal, but I just want to make sure that you are aware that Thomas More is not part of the conclusion. Because nothing in the premise proves that Thomas More did something. Okay? This is just a report of Thomas More's argument. Okay, number 11. Since there are no mental diseases, there can be no treatments for them. I like that. Go ahead. No, that's not the premise. I'm catching you on a slight thing because we're going to start getting picky here. You said the premise is, since there are no mental diseases. What's really the premise, Pat? There you go. Right. And how do you know that the premise is there are no mental diseases? What kind of indicator? Premise indicator. Okay. Number 12. All the game is Scottish in its ancestry. Golf has become an undeniably American pastime. An estimated 21.7 million Americans are golfers, and according to the National Golf Foundation, 8 million more will be playing by the year 2000. Jay? What about this part that says, although the game is Scottish in its ancestry? That's extra information. Okay. Not irrelevant, and it sets up why this is being said, but it's not part of the premise or the conclusion. 13. Since an individual's lifetime earnings typically follow an up-and-down pattern, low while a young adult, highest just before retirement, and then a leveling or reduction, there always will be a natural level of income inequality at any one time, if only because of the age distribution. Okay. If only because of age distribution strikes me as a premise. So what you have is an individual's lifetime earnings follow an up-and-down pattern. There's always an age. There's an age distribution. Therefore, there'll always be a natural level of inequality. Yeah, you might have to reword it to make it. Although you can just put, because of the, that's one of those noun phrases, the age distribution. You want to say there is an age distribution in society or something like that. Okay, number 14, missiles are easier to defend than cities for two reasons. First, missile sites are small and tough, or cities are large and vulnerable. Second, a defense of missile sites is considered effective if it can save half the missiles, whereas a defense of cities has to try to save them all. Okay. You've done well. Only one problem. I mean, you got the structure right, and this is not a big deal. But you broke this down into four premises. What is it that the author says here that would tell you that there's only two premises? Okay, he says, for two reasons. Now, sometimes authors say, just like pastors will sometimes say in the pulpit, I'm going to give you three reasons this morning for this, and then they give you four or two instead, you know. So sometimes it's hard to count. So you're not absolutely wrong in doing that, but I might have just said, well, there's two premises, two long ones with the whereases in them. Okay, let's move ahead. I think we've caught on to premises and conclusions pretty well. And just remember, what I've added that Kobe hasn't told you is that this is not an absolute science. A lot has to do with the ability to catch on to what the author or the speaker is trying to say. And to, in some sense, I don't want to make it mystical. Please don't misread me. But there is something about having a feel for it that goes beyond any rules or any objective public way that we can insist that everybody agree. This is what this isolated passage must be arguing and how it is arguing it. Okay, in section 1.3, Kopi begins to explain diagrams for single arguments, and he tells us very simply that a diagram is a spatial representation. The value of the diagram, by the way, they didn't do diagramming in the old days when I was in college. This is something that's new here. It isn't crucial, but it is valuable. It's valuable because it's good to see how arguments relate, how premises our statements in a passage relate to each other, so that we realize there are a lot of different ways to organize arguments. If nothing else, the diagramming will accomplish that. And then he gives the convention that he uses for diagramming. You go through the various propositions and number them, and use a circled number to stand for it, and then an arrow points to the conclusion. And then if you have two or more premises working together, you bracket them somehow, and then you have an arrow going to the conclusion. I just looked through the book, pages, 19 too, but 19, 20, 21, 22, and if you just look at those diagrams, that in itself teaches you what he wants you to learn here. You see how different arguments can be posed? The real easy one on page 20 is first premise, second premise, in the order of appearance in the paragraph, and then the conclusion, stated third. But then look at the second diagram on page 21. There you'll notice that the conclusion is the second assertion in the paragraph rather than the third. And then if you go above that, even the first assertion in a paragraph can prove to be the premise. The interesting thing about the diagram, the first diagram on page 21, is that you actually have two arguments for the same conclusion. One is a single premise argument, and the other is a double premise argument. So sometimes you have different ways of arguing for the same thing. Where's the page? Yeah, if you turn over to page 34, you see that sometimes you have the same premise proving two different conclusions. So it's just incredible all the variety that you can have as to how many arguments, what the order of mention of premises will be, how they're grouped together, and so forth. That's the value of the diagramming. He uses the convention of a broken circle if a conclusion is not explicitly stated but is supposed to be obvious enough. And I ask you to do some exercises, 1 to 5. All right, on page 22 in these exercises that are given, let me try to do number 5. And since that started, we can find out if I know what I'm doing. I have opposed the death penalty all my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. Okay, we have the first proposition, I've opposed the death penalty all my life. That could be a personal proposition. That is something about the individual, or it could just be the expression that the death penalty ought to be opposed, something like that. So that would be number 1. Number 2 would be, I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent. Again, either autobiographical about his beliefs or the assertion that there is no evidence that it's a deterrent. And then number 3 is going to be, I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. And as I read it, you have 2 and 3 bracketed, and I guess there should be an arrow here then, to number 1, which is the conclusion. First of all, before we check Kopi, who is, you know, he's not here to defend himself. Did any of you do it differently than this? Oh, no. Oh, so I did do it wrong. Well, good. Before I find out what I did wrong, let's see if we can, or I can learn from this, okay? Okay, I've opposed the death penalty all my life. I don't see any way for that not to be the conclusion here. And so, I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. It would seem that my mistake is that I bracketed those two together as though you have to team them up to draw that conclusion, but you don't need to team them up to draw the conclusion. Each by themselves would be grounds for that conclusion. So instead of diagramming it in the way that I have here on the board, we should actually have 2 leading to 1 with an arrow, and then up here 3 leading to 1 with an arrow as well. Now, did I get it right? Is that what the back of the book says? Okay. Very good. Well, let's give some of the rest of you an opportunity here to do this as well. All right, Pete, try number 2, the tough one. Okay, Pete, first of all, what do you think the conclusion in number 2 is? Okay, why isn't the conclusion that it has the advantage of being easier to inject? Well, it seems to me that it being more soluble means that it takes less to inject. It takes less mass, and if you have this information about the wasted person having little muscle mass to begin with. So the point is, it takes so much more morphine to accomplish the same thing that heroin will do, that is more mass. Therefore, it's easier to inject the heroin than the morphine. Let's ask the class, what all did you do with this, Pat? Yeah? You took the 50 times more soluble and the little muscle mass of the wasted person as premises to prove what? So that's a single line of proof for the same conclusion. I mean, an additional line of proof for the same conclusion. So that you have the 50 times more soluble and the little muscle mass proving the advantage that it's easier to inject. And then you have the 5 cc's of morphine. I'm sorry, what's the next part of the argument? So you have those 2 sentences as premises also showing the advantage that it's easier to inject. Okay, and what other lines do we have here before we... Okay, so you would agree with Pete's approach in that you think there's an implied conclusion. And that conclusion has to do with the advantage. It's advantageous to use heroin instead of morphine. one of the arguments is it's easier to inject. Right? Okay, but then what is the rest of this that explains it being easier to inject? Now, I see, here's the problem, and from my perspective, the artificiality of some of this, which contains a single argument. We know that means there can only be one conclusion that we're going to be working on here. And the approach that you are taking would mean that we'd have to drop all of those premises that prove that it's easier to inject heroin than morphine. And that doesn't seem very likely that he would put all that in there. And so I think what you've done and what Pete has done would be possible ways to take this. I'm not going to be real strict about this, as I've already indicated to you. However, given the rules that the author has laid down, the textbook author, very likely we are not to dismiss all those premises as completely irrelevant. They seem to all be ways of proving that it's easier to inject morphine. And then the question is, how many different lines of proof does he have for that conclusion? There's little drug, it's more soluble. Well, however you do it, I do think that's going to be the conclusion. It's easier to inject. And one of the lines of proof that it's easier to inject is that it's extremely painful to have an equivalent amount of morphine injected because of the little muscle mass of the wasted person and so forth. And the equivalent dose of heroin can be given to anyone, something like that. This one is a tough one. You were right. Yeah, I'm not sure that we were supposed to get anything from that necessarily. You were saying, Pat, the explanation for the soluble being mentioned? Yes, it's not half, it's 1/50, right? But the point is, it would take more vehicle in which to dissolve the heroin than it would, I mean morphine. It would take more vehicle to dissolve the morphine than it would to dissolve the heroin. And that's why it doesn't take as much mass, and injecting that much mass is painful. So, well, we spent enough time on this one. Thank you very much. I think you did good work trying to do it that way. Jay, why don't you do number 3 for us? Only in a reasonably tolerant society can civil disobedience flourish. That means we should expect more of it in a more just society, especially as a more just society is more likely to tolerate extreme views. What is the conclusion? And there's only one by the rules we're playing by here. Okay, does everyone agree with Jay that that's the argument? It seems to me that's the argument. Okay. Melissa, did you see it the same way?
We should expect more of it in more justice. That is more.
Civil disobedience. And the two premises would be only in a reasonably tolerant society can civil disobedience flourish, and a more just society is more likely to tolerate extreme views. Therefore, we should expect more of it in a more just society. And Jay has diagrammed this as two separate arguments for that conclusion. Does the class agree with him in that? Are those two separate arguments, or are they supposed to be teamed together? Say it again, Pete. Okay. If we team them together, then we're saying only in a reasonably tolerant society can civil disobedience flourish, and the more just the society is, the more likely it is to tolerate, and therefore, yeah, it doesn't seem to me that they separately support it. I think they do need to be teamed together, because the one tells you what will make for a just society, I mean for a tolerant society, and then the premise that a tolerant society will allow civil disobedience to flourish, and then you can draw the conclusion from justice to tolerance to the flourishing of civil disobedience. So very good. So we should bracket 1 and 3, leading to 2. Any disagreements now? Are we all having fun? This is the best part of the course. No, I'm kidding. We'll get through this. Actually, what we should do, because time is getting away from us, is turn to the harder exercises. And so let's go to page 30 in the book. But before we get there, there's some text about recognizing arguments that I want to review for you. Beginning on page 25, on recognizing arguments, turn to page 26, right in the middle, the author says about the example just given, no claim is made either explicitly or implicitly that any of them provides grounds or evidence for any other, so no argument is present. Okay, there is no argument. This is what we began with yesterday. We have to get this, you know, really firmly entrenched in our thinking. You don't have an argument unless somebody is setting forth some premise or premises in support of another one. And the author's just reminding us of that. If there's no implicit claim that certain premises provide grounds for the other premise that is taken as the conclusion, then there's no argument present. And then on page 27, he says, neither alternative nor hypothetical propositions involve the assertion of their component propositions. If I say A or B, I'm not asserting A and I'm not asserting B. I'm asserting A or B. That's a third thing, if you will. Count one as asserting A, count two as asserting B. A third kind of assertion is A or B without asserting one or the other. And then hypothetical propositions are the same way. If I say, if P then Q, I'm not telling you that P is true and I'm not telling you that Q is true. I'm just telling you that if P is Q, then if P is true, then Q is true as well. So the author tells us in the middle of the page, what is asserted is only that the former implies the latter, but both could be false for all the statement in question says. No premise is asserted, no inference is made, no conclusion is claimed to be true. There is no argument. And then, of course, the kicker is at the bottom of the page. Context, however, is extremely important. Well, yes, no kidding. When we try to do your exercises, Dr. Kofi, we find out we don't have enough context to be absolutely sure, you know. Context, and he mentions common knowledge, things that sometimes are just taken for granted that you have to fill in. And then I think it's important to notice on page 29 that he says, argument indicators sometimes have other functions as well as indicating arguments. That's part of the trick here, is that when you see those words that often give away premises or conclusions, they can be used in other ways as well. I'm not sure, I can't remember if he uses this example or your other author does. The word sense can have a temporal meaning. It can also have the logical force of this is the conclusion to be drawn, or these are the premises from which the conclusion is drawn. At the bottom of page 29, Kofi says that the word because can be an indication of an explanation rather than an argument. How do you know the difference between an explanation and an argument? He gives a hint on page 30. If we're interested in establishing the truth of Q and P is offered as evidence for it, then Q because P formulates an argument. That's trying to show the truthfulness of Q. However, if we regard the truth of Q as being unproblematic, as being at least as well established as the truth of P, but are interested in explaining why Q is the case, then Q because P is not an argument, but an explanation. I think that helps, doesn't it? When I use the word because, and I'm arguing for the truth of something else, then that's an argument. When I use the word because to explain to you how or why it happened, then I'm giving, obviously, an explanation. If the purpose is to establish the truth, or if the purpose is to explain or account for something, then you can see the difference between the logical and causal uses of the word because. Okay, now we come to the exercises on page 30, and you were supposed to do the first 10. No, hypothetical propositions are not arguments. Right. And I remember now as I was reviewing this, I was a little confused at that point too. The important thing to remember is that a hypothetical proposition does not assert the P or the Q, if P then Q. And for that reason, it's not an argument by itself. Although, no, it's not an argument. If you changed it to since P then Q, then you'd have an argument. Then Q is asserted on the basis of P. The other is just saying that if P is true, that Q has to be true as well. It's an assertion about a relationship between P and Q, but it's not an assertion about P or Q themselves. And page 30 then, we have the first 10. And he says, only some of the following passages contain arguments. Find those with arguments and diagram the arguments they contain. In the case of explanations, indicate what is being explained and what the explanation is. So let me follow the same teaching technique that we used a moment ago, see if I can be the goat here. I'll try to do number 5, and then we'll check the back of the book to see if I did it right. As I look at number 5, it seems to me that there's no argument here. That you don't have the truth of some proposition being asserted on the basis of other propositions, but rather you have a situation that's being explained. And the situation that's being explained is that scientists are perplexed. And why are they perplexed? Because they've detected a gamma ray source whose characteristics do not conform to conventional theories of physics. And then you have a further explanation of that by saying the radiation is a new twist on a common occurrence or a new occurrence altogether. So I'm ready to be slam dunk. Did I do it right or wrong? He scores. All right. So the author and the teacher agree. That always makes it easier on the students. Now let's see how you guys do. Who didn't get to diagram something here? Melissa didn't. Okay. Let's let you do number 2 then. Because their best physicists were not zealous for weapons, because they made uncorrected mistakes, because Hitler was Hitler, and because men like Speer always had more urgent production priorities, the Germans never really tried to make an atomic bomb. Well, let's work through this. Why at first did it appear not to be an argument? Well, now, if the premises didn't necessarily back it up, you might be telling us that it's a bad argument. It doesn't prove its point. But the question is this intended as an argument, or is this intended as an explanation? Well, tell me. But now you think it's an argument. Okay, now, what's an argument? An argument is some premise being asserted on the basis of other ones. So what premise is being asserted here? Now, what's the conclusion? Okay, so you're saying that here you have a proposition that is taken as the conclusion. The Germans never really tried to make an atomic bomb. And the truth of their not really trying to make an atomic bomb is urged on the basis of propositions that... Well, are you saying all the other ones because are then the premises for that conclusion? Let's get the rest of the class involved. Pete, what do you think? It's an attempt to explain it. Maybe it's a bad explanation, but it seems to me that you don't have an argument here. It's not the truth of the Germans never really tried to make an atomic bomb. It's more, here's why it came about that they never really tried. What do you think, Pat? Okay, well, we're all agreed that means it must be right. Truth is the majority opinion. And I'm just being lighthearted. Don't take me seriously here. Okay, well, then we need to let Melissa diagram something. Will number 4 be a good one to diagram, Melissa? Okay, let's read it, and then you tell me what you think the conclusion is. The steep climbing angle jet transports require for noise alleviation would cause passengers in rearward-facing seats to hang from their seatbelts instead of having the comfort that a backrest provides forward-facing seats in steep climbs. Because of this discomfort and the possible preference of passengers to look forward, coupled with the safety questions, the views of passengers should be established before rearward-facing seats are adopted. Well, before you come up, let's make sure that we have a conclusion here. What's the conclusion? The conclusion is the views of passengers should be established before... Okay, so you think that that recommendation is being urged on the basis of certain premises? Okay. Then how would you diagram it? Sure. Yeah, no, wait a minute. 1 and 2 you have bracketed together. And number 1 is... Rearward facing seats would cause passengers to hang without the comfort of a backrest in steep climbs. Number 2 this is uncomfortable. And for those two reasons together, do you draw the conclusion the views of passengers should be established? That doesn't seem to follow, though, does it? Okay. One reason why passengers should be consulted first, are their views established, is the discomfort of rearward-facing seats in a steep climb. And then 2 and 3 would be what? Preference of passengers to look forward, coupled with the safety questions. Now, how is it the preference of passengers to look forward is actually in the argument, coupled with safety questions, bracketed as you've done it? It doesn't seem to me 2 and 3 have to be put together for the drawing of that conclusion. Let me suggest, just so we can save some time, and you correct me. It appears to me that 1, 2, and 3 are all individual lines of support for number 4. Well, okay, do you accept that number 4 is the conclusion? The way you counted them, you mean? Okay, well, before we go on then, her 4 is your number 5. Do you agree that those are separate lines of argument? How about you? You said it was an explanation. Yeah, well, but it's not explaining anything, is it? There's no event taken for granted. There's this controversial idea that the views of passengers should be established before adopting something. And so you see, it's not like we all know that to be true. Now, how does it come about that that is, that's not being explained, that's being urged? The author is urging you, consult the views of passengers before you adopt this change. So I'm fairly convinced this is not an explanation, this is an argument. And I do think Melissa's got the conclusion right. I just don't think that 2 are bracketed. Now let's go back to Jay. Which 2 do you think should be bracketed? Yeah, I see. Yeah, well, he's counted them differently. One way of doing it is combine all of that into the premise that it would be a discomfort to be in a rearward-facing seat in a steep climb. And he's put 2 things together to show that. Okay. As we come to the end of this chapter, looking at the exercises that begin on page 40, this is a case of diagramming passages that have more than one argument. Remember, on page 34, this is a key, the author says the number of arguments in a passage is determined by the number of conclusions it contains. So whenever you're involved in doing analysis of an argument, or if you want to diagram it, the first thing you have to establish is how many different conclusions are found here, and then how are those conclusions supported, and how do they relate to each other. And for the sake of time, I'm going to do one on my own and then have the check of the author. Should I do number 1 or 5? What? Was number 1 difficult, did you feel? Okay, well, let's try number 1. General Mercier, leaving for Rennes to appear as a witness, issued his order of the day, quote, Dreyfus will be condemned once more. For in this affair, someone is certainly guilty, and the guilty one is either him or me, and it is certainly not me. As it is certainly not me, it is Dreyfus. And let me take a moment to reflect on this, and then I'll put it up on the board. All right, we'll take as our first proposition, Dreyfus will be condemned once more. The second proposition, in this affair, someone is certainly guilty. The third proposition, the guilty one is either him or me. And the fourth proposition would be, it is certainly not me, it is Dreyfus. Now, one argument that should be pretty obvious here is you have the guilty one is either him or me, and it's certainly not me. So we have 3 and 4 bracketed together. And if the guilty one is either him or me, and it's certainly not me, then the conclusion is, it is Dreyfus. Oh, there's 5 propositions. It is Dreyfus counts as a separate one. So 3 and 4 bracketed together prove 5.
then Dreyfus will be condemned once more because in this affair someone is certainly guilty. Okay, there must be someone guilty. Dreyfus is guilty.
Okay,
this may be too easy, but it seems then that if Dreyfus is guilty, if number five is proven from 3 and 4, that 5 then proves 1 as well, that he will be condemned once more, for in this affair someone is certainly guilty.
I guess 5 and 2 can be bracketed, and that would prove 1. Close? No banana? What does the textbook author say about it? Well, okay, one at a time. 2, 3, and 4 go together? Okay, so he has 2, 3, and 4 as proving, and then 5, 1. Yeah, well, I'm not going to bother to argue with him on that. In terms of the flow, it could be either way. Because here what you have is these two coming into one, add this in here, then you get the other, and here you just put them all together into a... Okay. Well, we've had enough fun diagramming arguments and so forth. I think the frustration that you feel in doing these exercises, I could have helped you with if I had been good enough to tell you ahead of time that there's room for disagreement, you know, and movement in this because we don't have the full context and so forth. And there may be, in some cases, equally legitimate ways of doing it. So please don't be discouraged by the difficulty of the opening exercises. Let's turn to Engel now and review what he has told us about logic and go over some of those exercises as well. Chapter 1 in Engel's book, With Good Reason. Before we actually get to Chapter 1, he has an introduction to Part 1 in which he likens logic to medicine. In the case of medicine, he says, it requires a knowledge of correct functioning before we can fully appreciate what often goes wrong. Logic is like that. And you have to understand, you have to have some good examples of reasoning in your mind before you can move out from that to find out what's wrong with other cases of reasoning. He reminds us that reason is only one of the tools used in argument, the other is language. That's why today's lesson is going to be equally important. You have to understand reason as well as language. The obvious point is much of what we hear, read, say, and think every day is less than correct from a logical point of view. Maybe I should stop just here and have a little devotional thought for you as Christians. It can be something we can laugh at each other about. I've taught classes where we joust each other about this. You're going to find out as you go along in this class, you learn more. You're going to be able to really slice and dice people. Because most people don't think about reasoning correctly. You'll be amazed. The more you pick up sensitivity to this, you can find it everywhere. In the grocery store, on the TV, talking to people. Maybe even in sermons. I mean, you're just going to find, well, that's not really a good argument. So forth. And if you bother to correct everybody, guess what? You're going to be a persona non grata real fast. Philosophers in general, logicians in particular, can become real pests. And so it's important that you develop not only your logical skills, but also your skills in sanctification and social relations, so you realize God hasn't made you everyone's teacher or corrector, and so forth. And try not to get discouraged when you find how little reasoning goes into what many people say and what we run into every day.
Okay, enough of a little devotional thought there. Engel tells us that the Greeks began to make catalogs of various errors, logical errors. That's what this book amounts to, is he's, in his own way, trying to continue this cataloging of how mistakes are made. Now, why do we do that? Well, in the same way that doctors try to catalog different diseases and medicines for dealing with them, it's easier then to identify and to treat situations when you know what some of the possibilities are and you've organized them systematically. And then he ends by telling us errors in logic can cause serious problems. We may laugh about many of the things in here. There's cartoons and all that. But the mistakes that people make in their reasoning can often cause tremendous pain and suffering and confusion in social circumstances or for an individual. Many times in counseling with people, I have found what I have to do is correct their thinking process. You know, they've gotten depressed or angry or whatever it may be.
because they have not been thinking clearly. So we can use the cartoon examples, but let's never forget that this is something that's very important at times in people's lives and the lives of societies. And he tells us we're going to sharpen our ability to recognize bad arguments by going through this book, and I hope that's true. Page 5, the opening, you're going to find a familiar definition. I've given it to you. Copy's given it to you. Engel says, one purpose of a study of logic is to gain tools with which to distinguish good arguments from bad ones. The only difference is he says that's one purpose. He doesn't go on to tell us what the other ones are, but generally this is considered the central purpose of logic. Is logic a science or an art? You may remember Copy gave, what, about one sentence to that, or... And Engel goes into it more in depth. There's a sense in which it's a science, and he brings up this interesting conundrum. Either we already know how to reason, or we do not. If we already possess the faculty, we need no instruction in it. If we do not possess it, instruction won't help us. And that looks clever, right? What's wrong with it? Well, the premise that says we either know or we don't. But it's not one of those sorts of things. We might know in part, but not completely. And so if we know in part, then the study of logic can help develop that partial grasp that we have. He points out that other people consider logic's value to be practical. It trains the mind, and I don't think we have to choose between the two. He indicates that the stress in his book is going to be the world of everyday affairs. That's one of the reasons why this is a popular book and Copy is kind of intimidating to people. It'll be much easier to read this. The explanations are easy. He's not nearly as precise or technical. In that sense, he's not as good an instructor in logic. In another sense, he's a more effective instructor because he can keep your attention and you don't, you know, run away from it. But he likes to use common examples, and that's a real value. Okay, in section 2 he tells us an argument doesn't mean quarreling. You've already been taught that. An argument, page 7, is reasoning in which one or more statements are offered as support for some other statement. He gives his own short list of premise indicators and conclusion indicators. What do you do when they aren't present? He says, where such indicator words are absent, try to find the conclusion by determining the main thrust of the argument. Ask, what is the point here? What does that tell you? There's a little bit of intuition, a little bit of experience in human language and relations. You just have to kind of go on background ability to identify what the point is when the indicators are not given explicitly. Yeah, he tells us in page 8 that sometimes the tone, well, that's really getting subjective and away from objective indicators. But he's right. Every once in a while, that's why we argue. I said, well, but from his tone, I thought he came down harder on this point than that, so that's his conclusion. Section 3, arguments and non-arguments. He says, if a piece of writing makes no claim supported by such reasons, it is not an argument. Thus, questions are not arguments, nor are announcements, complaints, compliments, or apologies. We have to be strict here. When we see some paragraph or hear somebody speak, if they are not saying this because of that, they're trying to support the truth of something on the basis of something else, they're not giving an argument. And then Engel gets into this ambiguity on because. You know, is because giving a justification or is it giving a clarification? He tells us sometimes what we have is not an argument for the truth of something, a justification, but just a further elaboration or clarification of what's going on. And then, of course, he discourages you on page 12 when he says, cases won't always be as clear-cut as the illustrations he's given. Sometimes explanation and justification simply blend into each other. When we look at examples, he says, ask for the primary intention. Is it primarily to justify or to explain? And if it is primarily to explain, then it's not an argument. In section 4, the author tells us, sometimes when you analyze the passage, you have to eliminate verbiage that's in there. Arguments are ordinarily expressed, are encumbered with a great deal of repetition, verbosity, and irrelevance. And it's good that we're reading Engel because that point needs to be made. Sometimes you just have to really cut out a lot of stuff so you can get to the heart of the matter or to the real structure of the argument.
He says it's best to rewrite arguments as concisely as possible with the premises arranged in their logical order.
If you rewrite the argument, it's easier to see what is really the heart of what the author is saying.
Also, to evaluate it. Now, in doing it, there'll be some loss, he says. We're going to have to discard some of the poetry or literary elegance. In section 5, he talks about highlighting suspect elements. An element is suspect if it's made to carry more weight than it's really capable of doing. We're going to ask whether sufficient evidence is being given, whether it's relevant evidence, whether it's even meaningful what the person is saying. He recommends on page 21 you not be intimidated. He says you shouldn't hesitate to demand proof when a presentation seems overblown or questionable. Ask questions about who is saying something, under what auspices, things of that nature. This section, as he tells you, is really just an anticipation of what the book's all about. The book's going to help you find suspect elements. Then, in analyzing arguments, sometimes there are missing components, section 6 tells us. An argument structure may be obscured because it is too sparse and has missing components. That is, there may be important assumptions made on which the argument rests that aren't stated. The example that he offers is where you have this kind of argument, an argument in this form, a generalization, a specific case, and then an applied conclusion. Now, where you have the generalization as the backing, the specific case as the observation conclusion drawn from it, it's pretty easy to see in arguments which element of that is missing and what you have to fit in. At the bottom of page 24, an important point is made. Not all such omissions are innocent or done for the sake of literary elegance or brevity. Often what is omitted is highly questionable and omitted for that very reason. When you look at advertisements and so forth, often what is not stated, which is necessary to make the argument work, is the very thing which is stated to draw your attention to it, and you say, well, you know, maybe that's not true. He says to state it explicitly is to call attention to it and risk having it questioned. So be aware of that. However, there are good reasons to omit things mentioned on page 26. It's simply too obvious, or for dramatic reasons, sometimes because you want to be more guarded and cautious in what you are asserting. All right. Section 7 deals with deductive and inductive arguments. I like the way he lays out on page 28. A premise can support a conclusion either fully, partially, or not at all. A premise can support a conclusion fully. There you have a deductive argument. Partially, an inductive argument. Not at all. You have a seductive argument, a fallacy. Notice he lists seduction along with deduction and induction. That's kind of clever. Okay, when an argument states that the conclusion follows with necessity from the premises, it's deductive. If it follows with probability, even high probability, it's inductive. And then he explains a little bit further that in the case of a deductive argument, the premises contained all the information needed to reach the conclusion that follows. Whereas with an inductive argument, you're always going a bit beyond the information provided to you in the premises. Okay, so if I say that such and such a drug has cured Pete of a certain disease, such and such a drug has cured Melissa of a certain disease, and Jay and Pat as well, and Dr. Bonson, and then we say such and such a drug will cure anybody of this disease, we've gone beyond the information we really have at our disposal. Now, it may be a safe step to take, but it's going beyond what the premises actually told us. Deductive arguments are evaluated as valid or invalid. How are inductive arguments evaluated? As strong or weak. Strong or weak. And the author tells you on page 31, most of the arguments you encounter in daily affairs are of the inductive variety rather than deductive variety. Okay, now section 8, he talks about evaluating arguments. Truth, validity, and soundness have to be considered. Validity, he says, refers to the correctness with which a conclusion has been inferred from its premises. Truth, on the other hand, refers to whether those premises and conclusion accord with the facts. Soundness results when the premises of an argument are true and its conclusion validly derived from them. And then he doesn't give as much detail as Copy does, but he shows there are various possibilities.
He says, our premises could be true and our inference valid, and then the conclusion would have to be true as well. Of course, that's number one's the nice one. That's what we always wish were the case. Number two, our premises might be true and we reason invalidly. Now, you can't tell then whether the argument is going to have a conclusion that is true or not. Sometimes it will happen to be true, sometimes it won't be. But even when it happens to be true, it won't be true because of the reasons given, because of the invalid reasoning structure, if you will. A third possibility is that one or more of the premises is false, and we reason validly from the false premises. Okay, he gives an example. All movie stars live in Hollywood. That's false. Robert Redford is a movie star. That's true. Therefore, Robert Redford lives in Hollywood.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.